This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Three statements to start things off. Today, Brexit is a mess, the global economy is complicated, and Starbucks coffee? Meh. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today the 29th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Hoo boy, has it been a busy day in London. We are 2 months, as of today, out from Brexit, and Parliament has been having something of a vote-a-thon, trying to come to some kind of resolution about the terms of their departure from the European Union. Among the motions considered, one from the opposition Labour Party to seek a customs union with the EU. That was rejected. Another to force Prime Minister Theresa May to try to delay Brexit if there is no signed deal with the EU by February 26th. Also rejected. A third to stop the UK from leaving without a deal. Passed but not legally binding. Prime Minister says she is going to renegotiate the withdrawal agreement she negotiated with Brussels. Brussels, the headquarters of the EU, says, no, you're not. So, with arguably the global economic disruption of this and the past many decades on the line, Marketplace's European correspondent Stephen Beard explains where Brexit goes from here.
I've been covering this story for 2.5 years now, every twist and turn of it. And I have to tell you, I have no idea what happens next. And I very much doubt anyone else does either. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Short but sweet, right? I mean, come on. How much more do you need? Another big global economic disruption for the past couple of decades has been the rise, of course, of China as a dominant force. And on that story, some news today in the form of Huawei, the Chinese telecommunications giant just indicted by the United States for stealing technology secrets and violating trade sanctions. The Trump administration has formally requested the extradition of the company's CFO, who happens to be the daughter of the founder. They want her from Canada. And a wireless company in Australia said it's going to stop building its mobile network for now because it relies on Huawei hardware, which is suspected of being a hacking threat. And that gets us back to global economic disruption. Because now that Huawei is in the news for suspected bad corporate behavior, what is that going to mean for the business of global telecommunications? From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
It's a big moment for telecom suppliers. Wireless carriers like Verizon and AT&T are spending billions on new hardware for the next generation of mobile known as 5G. Huawei is the world's top supplier, but the U.S. indictments raise new questions about whether it steals technology and violates sanctions. The Trump administration may ban Huawei gear from the U.S. entirely.
With this administration, definitely the chances have gone up.
Telecom analyst Michael Genovese at MKM Partners thinks Huawei's brand is damaged, which means opportunity for its big rivals.
This is actually a boon for Ericsson and Nokia, but politically they don't want to put that out there in their messaging because they're sensitive about being banned in China.
Meantime, Huawei is building a China-centric mobile network, raising the question of whether rival systems, East versus West, are developing around the world. Ann Stevenson Young is with J Capital Research.
Huawei, at least, is already encouraging its chip suppliers to move their production to China because it's concerned that it's going to come under export controls regimes.
In other words, American sanctions. For now, Australia and Japan have said no Huawei. Portugal's main carrier has said yes. And a German carrier is reassessing things as the Trump administration pressures its allies to reject Chinese companies. Retired Air Force General Rob Spalding recently left the White House.
you're going to see a continuing restriction of those companies within democracies going forward.
To him, this is an issue of economic and national security. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Stop me if you've heard this one before, but Apple made a ton of money last quarter. The company reported earnings today after the bell, did fine, thank you very much. But it's a safe bet the focus of much of the last 24 hours at Apple headquarters has not been earnings as much as it's been FaceTime, a bug that could let a FaceTime caller listen to the audio from an iPhone or an iPad that he or she is calling even before the person at the other end of the line had accepted or rejected the call. Apple says it has disabled the problematic feature, so there appears to be no danger right now. But while no company likes to find itself with a deeply embarrassing privacy issue, the fact that it's Apple, whose CEO Tim Cook has made it a point to say his company is all about protecting customer privacy, well, that's some news. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
It's been one of Apple's CEO Tim Cook's mantras. His company is a vigilant defender of consumers' privacy and security. Here he is on MSNBC back in March 2018.
You are not our product. You are our customer. You are a jewel.
And this.
We're not going to traffic in your personal life. I think it's an invasion of privacy.
There's certainly an irony in this incident.
That's tech analyst John Jackson at IDC.
Apple has gone out of its way to claim a sort of user privacy moral high ground, with Tim Cook repeatedly saying that it wouldn't use customers' personal data for things like ad targeting. He's been openly critical of Facebook and Google's models, which do exactly that.
Of course, the bug in FaceTime is just that, a bug. It's not a feature of the app. Cook's criticism of tech rivals has centered on their intentional harvesting of personal data. Equity analyst Angelo Zeno at CFRA Research says he expects Apple to get through this moment of bad PR just fine.
It's not a big deal. I mean, from time to time you have issues like this, and you know, we expect it to be addressed.
But Lauren Weinstein with the group People for Internet Responsibility is skeptical that Apple is so different from its competitors. He says the company also collects some data on its users. And as Apple sells more kinds of gadgets, like watches, there will be more bugs, too.
Now you have wearables. You have wearables talking to smartphones. You have smartphones talking to servers and maybe talking to desktops. You have a lot more, at least in theory, potential problems.
Apple didn't respond to a request for comment by our deadline. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This is a big week for tech earnings, the very latest tomorrow morning on the Marketplace Morning Report. But if you just can't wait till then, there's a quick primer on which reports to keep your eye on and why at marketplace.org. Apple shares lost some ground during the trading session, got a nice little bump after hours, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You can think whatever you like about the possible, probable, let's test the waters presidential candidacy of one Howard Schultz, but it is a cold, hard political and economic reality that for as long as he is in the race, again, assuming he actually officially does get in, that it's going to be a big deal for his former company. Starbucks' current CEO, Kevin Johnson, said the company doesn't get involved in national political campaigns, but as long as Howard is running, that's going to be easier said than done, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
Starbucks is in a tough spot, says John Wunderlich at the Sunlight Foundation.
Because if they distance themselves completely, it could be read as an indictment. But if they embrace his candidacy at all, then it's an endorsement and they run the risk of a backlash.
That's because Starbucks would be front and center of a potential Schultz campaign, whether the company wants it or not, says Kostas Panagopoulos at Northeastern University.
There's no point at which Schultz will go on the campaign trail and not mention the word Starbucks.
He says opposition research could start contacting Starbucks employees to try to dig up dirt on Schultz's tenure at the company. But overall, he says the bigger risk to Starbucks comes from consumers.
We're seeing more and more evidence that consumers are reacting to the political stances adopted by corporations in their purchasing choices.
Another risk? Schultz's campaign could also reinforce a public perception that Starbucks customers tend to be younger, urban, and liberal, says Paul Argenti at Dartmouth College.
If you're running a major corporation, you want everybody to love you, right? And you don't want to be associated with any political controversy.
Argenti says Starbucks should get ahead of any political issues that come up, such as compensation at Starbucks or Schultz's decision to encourage baristas to talk about race.
Like to make a list of the four or five possible things that could come up and create strategies for dealing with each of those things.
Starbucks didn't comment for the story, but the company has reportedly been studying other major CEOs who've run for political office. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This is a big couple of days for monetary policy watchers. The Federal Reserve meets today and tomorrow on interest rates and the general health of the economy. Technically, actually, I should say that it's the Federal Open Market Committee that's kicking off its first two-day meeting of the year. The FOMC is going to vote on whether to raise interest rates. Spoiler alert, they are almost certainly not going to raise rates. But the reason I mention it is that this being January, exactly who gets a vote has changed. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
When Fed Chair Jerome Powell walks into a press conference to announce the decision on interest rates, as he did last month.
Today, we raised our target range for the short-term interest rates by another quarter of a percentage point.
Powell may get all the glory or blame, but rates are actually decided by a vote of the FOMC. There are typically 19 members, but only 12 vote. Powell always, the six other Fed governors always, the head of the New York Fed always, but the presidents of the other 11 Federal Reserve banks spread across the country rotate, four on, seven off. Former Fed economist Ann Owen says there's a reason for that.
If all the bank presidents participated each year, then the regional bank presidents would then dominate the FOMC.
The rotation hasn't changed since 1913, when the Federal Reserve was established. Cities that had bigger populations back then, like Cleveland and St. Louis, get the vote every other year. For cities that were on the frontier, like San Francisco and Dallas, it's 1 year on, 2 years off.
Historically, the vote meant everything.
Peter Conti Brown is a Fed historian at the University of Pennsylvania. He says when it wasn't your turn to vote, you had no voice.
And so rotating out, as members of the Federal Open Market Committee would do, meant you were rotating into oblivion.
Conti Brown says the culture started changing in the 1980s when then-chair Paul Volcker was ratcheting up interest rates. Read the Fed transcripts and you see more and more input by those who didn't have the vote. By the time the financial crisis hit in 2007, everyone in the room seemed to have an equal voice. And there was plenty of disagreement. But
the nature of the culture is you don't want to seem like you're totally deviant outside the norm.
That's Richard Fisher, who was head of the Dallas Fed from 2005 to 2015. He says the Fed always presents a united front, but there are places to express yourself if you want to vent, like the speaking circuit.
I made a lot of speeches.
Speeches during the financial crisis about near-zero interest rates pouring so much cheap money into the economy that it was hurting savers and encouraging risky investments that over time might sink the economic ship.
And that liquidity could slosh around the hull of the ship, and if it got out of control, it could capsize the ship.
Reflecting on his decade at the Dallas Fed in 2015, Fisher spoke at the Economic Club of New York, where he called for the New York Fed to share the vice chair's position on the FOMC.
As I uttered those words, I could tell I was in a doghouse.
People have questioned whether the voting rotation should be more, let's say, equal, but that would take an act of Congress. In the meantime, Boston, Chicago, St. Louis, and Kansas City move into voting position today. Cleveland, San Fran, Richmond, and Atlanta move out. The shift isn't expected to tip the balance of the Fed any further toward raising interest rates. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
coming up.
For a lot of farmers, like, that's just such a huge boost.
Good soil, enough rain, and learning how to work a spreadsheet. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 51 points today, 0.2%, 24,579 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ fell 57 points, about 0.8%, 7,028. The S&P 500 down 3 points, about 0.1%, 26.40 there. After the bell, Apple reported profits and revenues that beat expectations, as I said, but iPhone revenue came in slightly below estimates. Before the announcement, Apple shares closed down about 1%. After hours, up about 3%, sometimes 4%. It kind of bounces around. PG&E, the big utility out here, rose 2% after it filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The investor-owned California company is facing billions of dollars in liability related to wildfires. You heard from Justin Ho about the challenges Starbucks could face if former CEO Howard Schultz enters the race. Today, up 0.2%. There's a polar vortex biting much of the country this week, as I'm sure you've seen. Then there is Polaris Industries, maker of snowmobiles and other recreational vehicles. Polaris down 1.9%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Artificial intelligence, whether we realize it or not, is in our daily lives, and it is here to stay. And we, that is, humans, are not entirely sanguine about what it's going to mean for us. That's the upshot of a new study out from Oxford University. Kelsey Piper wrote about it for Vox. Kelsey, it's good to have you on.
Thanks so much.
So we are going to, I'm going to let you interpret this study for us because you look at this stuff and you you report on it widely. I do want to start, though, on a somewhat hesitant note, and that is to point out that one of these researchers told you that people that they talked to in this survey are not convinced that AI, advanced artificial intelligence, is going to be to the benefit of humanity. That's slightly troubling.
Yeah, I do think that's slightly troubling. One thing that's going on there is a lot of skepticism about the AI systems we have now and whether they're helping. And then separately from that, a lot of skepticism about what AI is going to look like in 10 years.
Okay, so let's talk about what AI we have now. Are we talking like Siri and sort of the semi-autonomous car stuff that we've got going on? Is that what you're talking about?
So AI today, I think people point to Siri. They point to the translation services that have gotten a lot better over the last couple years, to semi-autonomous vehicles, also to the algorithm that Amazon briefly debuted to identify good hires that they found was actually using gender in order to decide who was likely to be a good software engineer. Also the algorithms that send you notifications on Twitter and Facebook that have been criticized for being addictive and encouraging people to spend more time on their phones than they want.
Okay, so if that's what we've got now with all of those problems, and I confess I had not heard about the gender thing at Amazon, are we counting on AI to get smarter by itself, or are we going to improve the inputs to the algorithms as we move toward advanced AI?
I think there's certainly a lot of experts who are sort of warning us here that, yeah, if AI safety research is moving slower than AI capabilities research, then we're going to have extremely powerful systems that still aren't doing what we actually want them to do and are sort of executing on their badly specified goals in ways that can be tremendously destructive.
Okay, wait, let's be clear about this. The people working on AI safety, we'll call it, are not the same people working on making AI smarter?
So there are definitely people whose work involves both, but there's a there's a lot of people who are working on making AI smarter who are not working on making AI safer. And the more conservative people I know working on AI safety tend to actually say, we don't think we should be making AI smarter right now. We think we need to sort of work on transparency and interpretability. That's understanding what algorithms are doing. We need to get that stuff right before we do more capabilities research.
There is an economic reality to AI, right? Which is this entire idea of technological unemployment and the fact that once machines can do it better than people, whatever that task is, up to and including speaking your native tongue into a microphone, people are going to lose their jobs, right? And there will be economic disruption.
Yeah, I think that was definitely one of the concerns that a lot of the public mentioned in the survey. In the past, technological development has just meant creating different jobs. And a lot of AI experts have said that. We'll see more people in caring professions teaching things where working with another human being is just powerful. But there are some people saying this one could happen so fast and be so disruptive as to sort of change the game there. And we need to be thinking about, you know, in a world where we don't need to work, are we going to have society structured so that everybody has enough and can choose how to spend their time? Or are we going to have a society where most people live in poverty?
Kelsey Piper at Vox, writing about artificial intelligence and the future of it. Kelsey, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
There are, according to the United States Department of Agriculture, more than 2 million farms in this country. Of those, the USDA says about a quarter are being run by beginning farmers, people who are relatively new to farming and so might not have the skills that are required beyond the actual farming part. Think the part that involves running a small business. So some California nonprofits are stepping in with business mentoring services for rookie farmers out here. Julia Mitrich reports as part of the California Dream Project.
Berta Magaña is looking over her 9-acre farm. She keeps her eye on a small farm crew moving along a row of strawberry plants. Magaña grew up in a family of farm laborers. She was a sharecropper and later worked in plant nurseries. Now, at 58, she's an independent farm owner on California's Central Coast. But she's still considered a beginner because she's run her farm for under 10 years. On this cloudy afternoon, she's got a visitor.
Berta! Señora Berta, buenas tardes.
That's David Mancera. He's part of a California nonprofit, the Kitchen Table Advisors, that works with small organic farmers and ranchers who are trying to scale up. He and Magaña talk about what mix of crops to plant and how to get bank loans. He asks her how the harvest is going.
¿Cómo le va ahora con la cosecha de las fresas?
Ahorita.
Magaña says it's the last strawberry harvest because the rain's coming. This is still a better yield than 2017 when she had some difficulties.
Porque este año tuve mejor producción.
For one thing, Magaña says her husband and farming partner had open-heart surgery. She couldn't harvest. But it helped that she and advisor Mancera had been working on a cash flow spreadsheet. It let the bank see that Magaña was tracking money in and money out, and she had a plan.
We don't tell them what to do. We guide them. We help them ask questions. Ultimately, they're the business owners. And so we're trying to help them develop this business mindset.
There's really no blueprint for becoming a small-scale farmer in California. Kristen Leach drives a tractor along a small plot of land she farms in the town of Winters, west of Sacramento. That's about 150 miles north of Magaña's farm. Leach, a Korean adoptee, got interested in traditional Korean farming as a way to connect with her heritage.
When I started my farm, it wasn't because I felt like a competent business person or had any even basic financial literacy as an individual.
She started out working for other farmers, and she had a restaurant job. Growing veggies was just a side hustle. Now Leach, who's 36, actually makes a living growing heirloom Korean chilies, herbs, and melons for an upscale San Francisco restaurant.
So it's sort of been like accidental business owner.
That's the case for a lot of beginners, says Evan Wigg of the Community Alliance with Family Farmers. The nonprofit advocacy group runs training and networking for rookie farmers.
We see farmers over and over again coming with a passion and interest and knowledge in crop production, in working with soil health management, and really that's usually what draws new people to agriculture.
Not the prospect of sitting behind a computer, filling out spreadsheets for crop planning, which is also part of the job. In California, land close to markets like San Francisco is expensive and hard to come by. And when small farms fail, Wigg says,
it's almost always comes down to some element of business planning.
Farmer Kristen Leach also gets guidance from a kitchen table advisor. She says the connection has helped her scale up her business and expand seed production.
For a lot of farmers, like that's just such a huge boost to just not feel alone in it or have people that are kind of advocating for you and can provide resources of one kind or another.
Leach says she's still learning from her advisor. She no longer runs her farm paycheck to paycheck, but she also says she's still stubborn enough to farm her own way. In Sacramento, I'm Julia Mitrich for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which, no comment. With Valentine's Day around the corner, a zoo in the UK, the Helmsley Conservation Centre, will let you, for the low, low price of about $2, it's a pound and a half sterling technically, it'll let you name a cockroach after your ex. Here's the slogan. For those that don't quite require revenge, there is another way to make you feel better about getting back at your ex this Valentine's Day. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's up 51 points today, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 57, 0.8%. S&P 500 down 3, that's 0.1%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Barbara Platts, Brian Ronahan, Arjuna Soriano, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.